Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
This was the scene on board before takeoff. On the way to the biggest game in the club's history, the team is in good spirits. And so is the crew. I think we'll return with good results, he says. Striker Kempes joins in. Being taken by Lamia makes it all right, he says. The co-pilot was filmed saying Lamia Airline is always transporting soccer teams and we're ready to offer them the best service. But instead, just hours later, the pilot makes this distress call to air traffic control. His voice calm, he tells the operator the electrics have failed and he's run out of fuel. The operator tries to help him land. But then the pilot's final word. Seventy-one people died when the aircraft plunged into the Colombian mountainside. Brazil's O Globo newspaper reports the pilot declined two chances to refuel.
Lamentablemente vimos cuerpos por todas partes.
This rescuer said he could hear people crying for help when he arrived at the scene.
Sí, claro, en la parte.
Several people at the rear part survived, he said. It was in fact six people, including three players. Relatives arrived in Colombia today to bring their loved ones home. All the players have now been identified and will return to Brazil in a military aircraft. They'll come directly to the club's home stadium for a service. The stadium that has now become a shrine. Tributes led by the few players left behind.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and I'm delighted to say that once again we're journeying back into the centre circle where we have wonderful author and no disrespect to the author, but the story is actually even more wonderful and hopefully the author agrees and hasn't just left after that intro, but it's an incredible book. Superbly written, and the story is such a wonderful story, and the author does it incredible justice, and it's a story that certainly needed to be told, and it needed to be told in a certain way, and as we go through this, and the people who've already read it hopefully will agree, and if you haven't read it, hopefully that after this sort of hour and a bit of chat, it will encourage you to go get it and just sort of read what a wonderful job this guy has done with the story. But before we come to the author and into the discussion, obviously it's important to introduce the co-hosts, co-compadres, co-conspirators. I can't think of any more co's. Sebastian Co, but no. Stephen, you're the first one. Welcome.
Oh, how are we doing, Stu? Looking forward to this one.
Yes. Yes, most definitely. Not only, like I said, not only chatting with the author who's written it, which is always really, really good to get sort of the inside track on a book, but also the story itself. It's almost a twofold podcast, I think, this one.
It is. There's it's one of these where there's just like so much to learn, you know, and it's that appreciation for, you know, a team, not just for the sense of loss for them, but for what they achieved in getting to the position that they were just about to embrace. Yeah. Amazing team and amazing story.
It absolutely is. And other regular co-host in the centre circle, the other central midfielder in this midfield three that we operate on this podcast, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, great to be on board again in the centre circle. And you know, as you said earlier, this is a story that had to be told. And the guy we've got on tonight tells it wonderfully well. It's a fantastic story, and it's a fantastic book. And it covers the highs and lows of not only football but life and beyond that. So yeah, looking forward to this immensely, mate.
It's, No, I was going to say, it's funny, isn't it? We seem to be sort of talking about stories that are very human stories that obviously our football is the backdrop. It's what we do, it's what we talk about. But we seem, you know, sort of at the moment, there seems to be a sort of a thirst for sort of human stories, if you like, with football as the backdrop, you know, not just in this one, but, you know, certainly in the last sort of two or three that we've done, there seems to be a real craving for, you know, sort of the humanizing side of football, I guess. And this is probably one of the ultimate stories that does that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, perhaps one of the reasons for that is that football's a great metaphor for life, and it opens up the consciousness to highs and lows and not many things in between. So, yeah, it provides a wonderful backcloth for stories about people and you know, and lives and how they're lived.
I guess, you know, we'll sort of do the introductions now for our special guest and what it is we're going to talk about tonight. So to begin with, you know, it was great anticipation. 2016, it's the Copa Sudamericana final. Colombia's mighty Atletico Nacional was set to host, you know, the first leg of this final, heading their way, and they were shock finalists. Shock finalist Chapecoense, whose run to the showpiece event, you know, was literally nothing short of meteoric. It's a club that had been playing Serie D football in Brazil literally 7 years earlier. And so it sort of shocked not only sort of South American football, but football lovers all around the world. It was a, you know, their story was one that captured the imagination of the little club going on to big things. And, you know, and as the club set off for Medellin, nobody obviously could have foreseen the tragedy that was to come. And tonight, like we said at the beginning, to talk about this, and it is a heartfelt book on this topic. And it's a book called From Triumph to Tragedy, The Chapecoense Story. It's the author and our special guest, Mr. Stephen Bell. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you, Stu.
Like I say, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you. And like I said, there was no disrespect meant in the introduction, but the story, you know, the story of this team almost will always precede anybody who chooses to write about it or chooses to comment on it. You know, the story is always going to be bigger. It's just being, for me, it's about being big enough and brave enough, I think, to take on a story that needed to be handled carefully. I guess, you know, it's an emotive story. It's still relatively recent event. But before we sort of get into that, if you could just obviously overview the book, overview the story for people who maybe don't know. And I suppose probably more importantly for me, that the rationale behind why you chose to write this book.
Well, as you've said, Stu, obviously, absolutely, no offense taken, you're absolutely right. The story is so immense. It sort of changed my life at the time. It made such a big impact on me. I'd got an affinity with Brazilian football. That goes all the way back to when I was a child. I got really addicted to international football, not to give me age away, but the 1994 World Cup was my first sort of major tournament. England weren't there in the sunshine of that glorious summer in America. I've got the glistening golden shirts of Brazil. When they won it's something I'll never forget, watching that tournament. And then 2 years later, Euro 96, finally got to see England in a tournament. Fell in love with that, obviously. It just took the country by storm. Yeah, I'd just become sort of an international football addict. And then, so when the 2014 World Cup was in Brazil and England were there, I just felt I had no choice. I had to be there, I had to go. So I booked an apartment, me and two friends, booked an apartment for the full six weeks. Unfortunately, as we know, England were only there for two. But hey, what can you do? So it was a fantastic 6 week. I really got an affinity with the country, fell in love with the country, learned a bit of the language, you know, trace of Asia, obrigado. And we sort of went from there. I came home. We were staying at an apartment in Rio that was around the corner from the old Flamengo stadium, which is then used as a training ground. So I sort of took them on as my team, bought the shirt, bought some merchandise, came home, thought, right, I've got a new team, I'm going to follow the results. And I'd in particular met a really close friend over there who were a friend of the lady whose apartment we booked, but he just sort of took us under his wing. He wanted us to show his city, that's how friendly they are. He took us everywhere, showed us the sights, taught us some history, learned us a bit of the language. So we stayed in close contact. And I'm following Brazilian football, following the Brasileiro a little bit. And suddenly my team, my new team, Flamengo, in the August of 2014, after I've come back, they lost 1-0 to a side near the bottom of the league, Chapecoense, first time I'd ever heard of that team. So I just, you know, did a bit of internet wormhole, following each link, find out where they'd come from, found out this amazing sporting story they were on. They had absolutely no right to be in Serie A, let alone beating the mighty Flamengo. Like you said, just a few years earlier, they'd been effectively in non-league. They were on this amazing meteoric rise through the divisions without any sort of influx of money that we see in this country, just genuine hard work, team ethic. So all of a sudden I had two Brazilian teams that I wanted to follow. And then the story continued a couple of years later. They'd managed to stay in Serie A. Not only that, they'd qualified for the Copa Sudamericana 2 years on the trot, which is the South American equivalent of the Europa League. And then in the second season that they qualified for that in 2016, they'd miraculously got all the way to the final. And I'll never forget that morning, obviously, because of the time difference and one thing and another. They were travelling overnight their time, but it was even in the deeper and darker part of the night to us. And I woke up to some alerts as we get on his iPhone these days, you know, messages up front of my phone. Sky Sports News, Chapecoense airplane has crashed. And yeah, I felt my heart sink straight away. I think as you do with that, or certainly I do, maybe being a bit of an optimist in life, I thought it won't be that bad. You know, it must have been a bit of a crash landing maybe, you know, there might be some injuries, but you know, you always think things aren't as bad as what that first deadline are going to make them out to be. Well, this ended up being quite the opposite as the hours and days went on. It just turned into this catastrophic news story and event, and it takes quite a lot for a Brazilian football story to make it into the news over here, but it did. It was in the papers for a few days, but it were quite literally just a few days, and then it just disappeared, and that weren't enough for me. I wanted to know more. I followed the story, kept in touch with my close friend in Brazil. He was sending me news articles, translating parts of them, or even sending me news videos where he himself managed to put the English subtitles on for me. Bless him, it was absolutely fantastic. And I sort of accidentally, over the next few months, find myself almost becoming accidentally a little bit of a expert on the subject, just because of a thirst to know more about it and know what had happened. And as the months went on, more and more truths came out about exactly what had gone on, why it had happened, how it had happened. But by then, it had completely disappeared from our news. And yeah, we're at that point. I decided that somebody should write a book about it. That's sort of a long-standing dream of mine. Anyway, to write a book. And I just one day thought, well, if I don't do it about this, I'll never do it about anything. So I just decided to give it a go. And it seems to have been well received. As you say, it were a delicate subject at times to put down on paper and convey them emotions, especially the more and more research I did, the people that I spoke to. And yeah, it were hard at times. It were really hard, but very satisfying to sort of bring the story to life and to let people know exactly just how catastrophic it was.
It's really not difficult. That's probably the wrong word, but it's, you know, this story, this podcast, you know, it's going to have immense highs and lows, and it's going to have periods of sort of sadness and sort of remembrance almost. And it's going to have periods of sort of celebration and joy, you know, even just throughout this episode. And I guess that's part of the journey that you went through with regards to writing the book. But I just want to come to you, Stevie. Normally, because I'm going to have to call you Stevie instead of Stephen, by the way, otherwise there's going to be all sorts of problems as to who's answering what. So coming to you, Steve, first of all, it's the chance moment, you know, writing books, you know, undertaking a big task, doesn't matter what the subject is, but sort of listening to Stephen there and his sort of trip to Brazil, and it's, you know, and he's booking it and he's with his friends, you know, there's no inclination, and life is like that, there's no inclination that this trip is actually going to lead to a book about an event that hasn't happened yet, but yet these sort of, the serendipity, these sort of seeds are sort of being sown along the way, and then all of a sudden there's just a thing or a moment or a trigger that compels people to then write in detail about it.
Yeah, it's that point of genesis, isn't it? It's, there'll be something, you know, like you say, whatever that topic is, there'll be, you know, a kind of genesis where you take something of that place or that topic or what it is you've seen, and it never leaves you. And, you know, it just rattles around the subconscious. And then eventually, you know, luckily enough for all of us involved in this podcast, we've managed to write a book out of something that we've picked up along our paths, and in the hope that someone will, not even the hope that someone will enjoy it, just the fact that, you know, it's a story we want to tell. And I've often said that, you know, writing an article or writing a book, primarily it's something that you write because it's a story that you initially want to read yourself, and you feel like either no one's done it before or no one's written it in the way that you want to read it before. So, you know, always with whatever you're writing, long or short, you know, the author is always their own first audience, basically. And you know, you are the key demographic, basically. And then it's putting it across in a way that, you know, there are other like-minded people out there that think, yes, this is the book, and this is, I want to read about this. And it's an amazing thing. And then it tends to snowball. And eventually it just plays itself out in a way that you could never imagine. But for Stephen to do that and to do it with the topic that he's selected, or selected him even, it makes it even more amazing, because it's not just a story of goals scored and deeds done on a pitch. This is kind of like a legacy, you know, telling the story of people who can no longer tell the story for themselves.
It's a great point. You know, you're right. It's, you know, and it's something that I want to come on to a bit later on as well, in terms of the responsibility of telling, you know, of telling such an important story. And like you say, you're almost speaking for people who aren't here anymore, or you're sort of hoping to tell a story that you hope will do them justice, will do the memory justice. And I do want to chat, Stephen, about the pressure that, or if pressure came with that. But for you, Gary, you know, Brazil and football, you know, it's so synonymous, I'm not quite sure how to word this, but football is such an integral part of the country, of its, you know, of its culture and society. But also when you have this sort of an incident, you know, and Stephen mentions that, you know, it's gone from the news within sort of 3 or 4 days. But yet, you know, in Brazil, the game is sort of tied up in almost daily life every day. And then you have this incident. It was such a huge story at the time.
Oh, definitely. You know, if you go to anybody, I say anybody, 9 out of 10 people, you say, tell me one thing about Brazil, they'll say football. If you just 9 out of 10 people, if you ask 10 people, get 9 answers, you say, which country do you most associate with football? They'll say Brazil. And that's how tight the tie is. So, yeah, I mean, both elements of the story, both the sort of uplifting charge to the divisions, the unlikely success in the Copa Sudamericana, and then the tragedy of the crash afterwards, would both have been big news in Brazil, and, you know, and certainly for a lot longer than 2 days. But it shows something about the insular quality of British, what's the word I'm looking for here? British, the perceived interest of football fans, should we say, not the interest, but how newspapers perceive in the interest to be. And it's, you know, it's to Stephen's great credit that, you know, I mean, we, you know, the three of us have all written books, and we've written books about things that we, you know, we sort of know about, or sort of are within reach. But writing the story of Chapaco Ense must have took an immense amount of research about a club that, you know, people hadn't heard of. And, you know, some people had heard of it before they before the crash, and a few more would have heard of it after the crash. But, as you know, as Stephen said, then you disappeared out the news cycle quite quickly. So to get this intimate recollection of the events is a massive achievement by Stephen.
It absolutely is, and sort of, you know, coming to you, Stephen, like you say, you were there for the World Cup. We all know how that sort of played out. Ultimately, we certainly know how it played out for Brazil. But, you know, when you were there, in terms of the nation, you know, it's got a very, certainly politically, you know, the history of the nation is very coloured. It's very changeable. It's been through the mill, you know, with regards to styles of leadership, different leaders, you know, even including the current president at the moment. But, you know, when you were there in sort of 2014, in and around that World Cup, you know, how did you find the nation of Brazil?
I just fell in love with it, Joe. The people are just the friendliest people that you could ever hope to meet, and it's just got this, particularly Rio, this vibrancy about it. You know, you can't quite place what it is, but there's just something in the air and don't get me wrong, the World Cup being there at the time massively helped that, I'm sure. But yeah, you're going back to the football passion that they've got. I think it's something that we've lost in this country a little bit due to the influx of particularly money, but, you know, the sort of corporate side of it and the just complete detachment in sort of standard of living and money that the players have got. It's just not a working man's sport anymore. It still is in Brazil, and Brazil has got one of the biggest sort of social disparities between the rich and the poor that you could possibly imagine in the world. You know, 50% were more, 50-60% of the country live in complete abject poverty, but the rich are very wealthy. And in the big cities like Rio, you've literally got your homeless strewn along the street. You've got your favelas that you can see, you can almost touch. And you know that there's just complete poverty stricken. There's crime. There's, you know, people aren't even sort of registered on the system. It's that kind of poverty. No healthcare, no state education. And yet you've got these big high-rise apartment blocks with, you know, beach views over Copacabana and Ipanema beaches. It's really humbling to see the disparity there. It's something that we've got in this country, but that is a different league. But football for them is the great social equaliser. The gentleman who owns the high-rise flat, his biggest passion in life will be seeing his team score a goal, score a winning goal in a football match, be it Brazil or be it his club side. The guy in the favela who's got no shoes on his feet, his biggest passion in life is seeing his football team score. It is that kind of, it just runs through the core of the country. And it still does to this day. And that's what I really noticed. No matter who you get talking to in the street, all they want to talk to you about is football. Even if they didn't speak English, we managed to communicate about football every time. And that's why I came away so keen to start following the Brasileiro. And yeah, that is how I ended up on this story. What I didn't realise while I was there was that I was there during Chapecoense's first season in Serie A after this meteoric rise. They'd broken off from their season for the World Cup And as we came back, that season restarted. They were in this big relegation fight that nobody gave them a chance in. They didn't think, nobody thought they had any right to be in Serie A. And then, as I say, the first time I stumbled across the name was because they'd beaten Flamengo.
It is an incredible story, and you know, I want to get into the rise of the club, and you know, and sort of set the scene for what, you know, unfortunately is to come. But before we do that, I guess Gary, you know, going back to what Stephen just said there, you know, in football, you know, we like to think here that, you know, football is the sort of the great unifier. You know, everybody has an opinion on it. If my mum either knows about it or has an opinion on it, it must be important. Football is one of those things that she knows. And your comments earlier, Gary, you know, if you ask somebody which country you associate with football, even my mum would say Brazil. And so that's the sort of impact. But to talk about what Stephen was saying, and that's how it does unify what is quite a disparate nation, be it through wealth, be it through politics. You know, that football is that single unifying factor within the country.
It is, yeah. I suppose it's sort of unifying, almost a bit sort of, you know, disunifying, for want of a better description. You know, with to you know, people support different teams and clubs in different divisions. But certainly when Brazil playing, certainly in the World Cup, you know, it's really strange. I mean, Brazil have won the World Cup more times than anybody else, and they've hosted twice and never win either time. It's really, really strange when you sort of consider it. And the sort of lamentation when Brazil sort of failed to face it to themselves, justice, I suppose, in the competition must have been immense. And, you know, just to sort of clarify, you know, sort of illustrate your point, that would have been a mass disappointment that spread across the entire country. I remember I read a piece about Pelé when they lost 1950. Game against Uruguay, and Pelé said it's the only time you ever saw his father cry. And you know, you're thinking, okay, and it's a nice little sort of metaphor for, you know, when you know Brazil loses a big game of football, the country weeps.
I mean, you know, you're absolutely right, and I guess, you know, coming to you, Steve, that sort of 2014 World Cup, and it's, you know, like Gary said, Brazil are the host nation. They've hosted it twice, and you know, and they've lost, and those defeats are incredibly contrasting defeats, but almost equally devastating in the way those defeats manifest themselves. And you know, and I know this is about Stephen's book and, you know, the story of this side, but I think, you know, I think we do need a little bit of context about the nation, football, and its relationship with Brazil before we get into the story of the club in a second. But yeah, those two defeats in 1950 and 2014, very different but equally devastating.
Yes, you know, it tends to haunt Brazil, you know, these losses, these defeats, and they're agonized over in painstaking detail and depth. There tends to be, you know, government inquiries over them and all sorts of things. You know, it is an absolutely, you know, era-defining moment. You know, we're talking Zapruder, 1950 and 2016, so 2014 will forever, you know, lay within the psyche of Brazilian football and the national team, no matter what they've done, no matter the successes they've had. You know, it's those losses in 1982 you can throw in there as well. It's that concept of why not, rather than, you know, we did. So 1970, as much as it's celebrated, it seems to pale into insignificance compared to the losses. And I think this played into the hands of Chapecoense's run fantastically, because the fact that they were underdogs, you know, the concept of the underdog wasn't really something that top level Brazilian football had ever really experienced or had to, the chance to appreciate. You know, as I said earlier, this is a team that 7 years earlier were essentially playing amateur football down in Serie D, and then here they are in the Copa Sudamerica final, and by no means was it a fluke. You know, the previous season they got to the quarterfinals. They'd only gone out very, very narrowly to the mighty River Plate. You know, this was a run, you know, in 2016 that took them past Independiente, the most successful team in Copa Libertadores history. They saw off San Lorenzo, you know, Atletico Junior, you know, another team they beat along the way would go to the Sudamerica final 2 years later. You know, these were significant opponents that Chapecoense overcame, and while the football stylings wouldn't, you know, be the same, this was akin to, you know, if you, we always try and find a British or an English, you know, equivalent, but you could look at, say, Wimbledon and the, you know, incredible rise, and they got to the top flight of English football, 86, 87. I think they finished as London's top finished side that season. They reached the quarterfinals of the FA Cup and then went one better the following year. So this is a rise that's kind of like similar to that in a way, but this is something that would have been completely just bewildering to the senses in Brazil. And on the back of that epic defeat to Germany in the semi-finals of the 2014 World Cup, this must have been such an antidote to that. Such an uplifting thing in the wake of what had been such an embarrassment, basically, for Brazilian football in that epic defeat in 2014 in the World Cup.
It's a great point. You know, it's a great point there where, you know, you sort of mention how this side and the story of this side, you know, is almost, it's a bit like sticking a plaster over a wound, I guess. You know, that sort of 7-1 semi-final defeat to Germany, but. Stephen, just I suppose just a little bit, you know, we've sort of hinted around it at this sudden and rapid rise of this side, you know, and Steve just mentioned there the sort of, you know, the comparison with Wimbledon, but just how dramatic was the rise of this side?
I don't actually think, I think Wimbledon's about as close a comparison as you could get. The one that springs to my mind, not from a British point of view, but just because of the love I have for the book, and probably that's what inspired me to try my hand at sports writing, it would be Castel de Sangro and the story that Joe McGinnis tells in The Miracle of Castel de Sangro. I think that's the level of our team are literally down at an amateur football team down at grassroots football, suddenly, through inexplicable reasons, find themselves mixing with teams and players that they probably themselves felt they've got no right to be mixing with. When you see it happen in this country these days, it's usually, I mean, it's not on to that level of extent of how far they've jumped up, but there's usually some level of money influx. There's usually, you know, it's explainable. This Chapecoense rise is, well, I do explain it in the book, but it even baffles me when I talk about it, when I write about it. It shouldn't have happened. You correctly say, Stu, that we've spent quite a lot of this chat talking about Brazil as a nation and Brazil as a football nation, as you put it, to add context. Well, that's exactly what I've chose to do in the book, because at the same time that Chapecoense were pretty much out of business, they were an amateur football club. I mean, we've mentioned Serie D a couple of times here, but in 2009, they actually went into the 2009 season not even in Serie D. The way Brazilian football works is that they play the first few months of the season in their state championships. And then the teams that are lucky enough to be involved in the National Brasileiro, that kicks in May. So the teams that aren't in the Brasileiro, they have to shut up doors. And the players are all minimum wage, which minimum wage in Brazil is pure poverty. And they have to shut up their doors in May. and then players have to become bin men, market tradesmen, to support the families. That is the level of poverty that we're talking about. It's the level of football that we're talking about. It's complete amateur football. And I've added that Brazilian national team and discussion of the Brazilian national structure and the passion towards football as context into this. You know, these players just want to be footballers. And at the top of the tree, at the same time that these guys are living in complete poverty, you've got your Ronaldinhos of the world, you know, absolutely redefining football, Ronaldo redefining football. And so that context is great to have. And these guys, these are just people, human beings following the dreams, but the dreams just aren't coming true. At that stage in 2009, they went into their state championship, assuming once again that they would finish that state championship mid-table, as they would. But they just managed, by the skin of the teeth, they managed to get it to the semi-finals of the playoffs. They only got to the semi-final, but that was just good enough to get them qualification into the Serie D. Now, Serie D, the way that works, even that isn't a national tournament instantly. It's regionalised small groups. And then regionalised small groups of maybe 10 teams, it's either you get through to the playoffs, at which point you probably, because of the way the numbers work, you're probably going to end up in Serie C, which obviously is some security. Everybody else, it's out. You're back down to your state championship. It's complete jeopardy. So they went into Serie D. They just scraped there by the skin of the teeth. But it was great. They got to keep the gates open for the last 8 months of the year. Fantastic. But it was assumed that that's all it would be. They managed to, again, just scrape into the next round of the Serie D and just scrape by... You know, every time Chapecoense either escaped relegation or qualified for the playoffs or got promoted, it always seemed to be by away goals or by goal difference. You know, it was dramatic to the end every single time. So all of a sudden, they've managed to find themselves actually in Serie C just by scraping into Serie D through the state championship and then scraping into Serie C through Serie D. So Serie C in 2010 offered them some level of security. Then they're in a proper national league of 20 teams. Still with much the same squad, the same tiny budget, non-existent budget. But at least they'd got that level of security. Only four teams were going down out of a team out of a national league of 20. They spent three seasons in Serie C, and in the third season, they managed to finish third. By that point, the club was becoming really well run behind the scenes. They were really developing the coaching, investing. Local businessmen were getting on board for sponsorship, putting money into the club. The town that were becoming really proud of the club. And so when they managed to finish third, they'd signed some good players, but it always seemed to be the right kind of player, the right kind of person. One of the key moments when they signed an experienced player called Cadu Gaucho, a box-to-box dynamic midfielder, a leader of men, a real leader on the pitch. He took games by the scruff of the neck. He took control of the dressing room. And yeah, it really started to change from there when they got promoted that season. He'd actually been offered a big contract with a team already in Serie B. He showed loyalty to Chapecoense because of the project that they're on and the sort of how popular he was there with the fans. But just before they got promoted, he got a career-ending injury. But the club showed loyalty to him like he'd showed it to them, and they offered him they invented a position for him to act as the sort of role that we'd know as a director of football, acting between the changing room and the board of directors and the management, because he was so popular with both sides. He was the perfect man for that role. He expanded that role into scouting. He was so well respected within the lower leagues of the Brasileiro all the time that he'd spent there, all the years that he'd played there. and he knew the players down there, knew the characters. So when they went up to Serie B, again, somewhere that thought that was the highest that they could possibly ever go, all of the Brasileiros were surprised that they managed to get that high. And this is now 2012, going into the 2013 season. He managed to recruit players that he knew were the right kind of player and the right kind of person for Chapecoense. And it really started to come together. He signed a player called Bruno Rangel, a striker, journeyman, a complete journeyman striker, who'd actually given up football a couple of times because he needed to support his family and he couldn't do it playing only in the state championships or only in Serie D where it was so uncertain. But he knew Bruno Rangel. He'd played against him so much. He knew his qualities. He gave him the confidence and he went straight inside him. Bruno Rangel blew Serie B away that season. He scored 31 league goals. And Chapecoense took Serie B by storm. Palmeiras, the mighty Palmeiras, had actually, by some sort of freak by their standards, had been relegated the season before, so they'd found themselves in Serie B. But Chapecoense, at the midpoint of the season, were flying out at the top of the league. Palmeiras came on strong at the end. But with Bruno Rangel just continuing to bang the goals in, he finished the league's top goal scorer by a mile, despite these, you know, top players that Palmeiras had. And yeah, they managed to cling on to second place and get promoted. And to the whole country's surprise, Chapecoense were in Serie A. Towards the end of that season, they'd started recruiting in preparation for it, and that included signing just a backup goalkeeper called Danilo. Again, a player who'd played only in the state championships that year, so were completely out of work. He was out of football for the time being and waiting patiently for the next state championships to come. But again, Cadu Gaucho plucked him as a backup goalkeeper. They were so impressed with him towards the end of the season that they decided to give him the gloves for the season in Serie A. So he'd gone from being effectively out of work, unemployed footballer, to being a first-choice goalkeeper in the top division. The faith that he'd shown in the likes of Bruno Rangel and Danilo at either end of the pitch went on to be pivotal, as they ended up becoming absolute godlike legends of the club with the performances in Serie A and in the Copa Sudamericana, as Steve said. The first season that they qualified for the Copa Sudamericana, they went on this unbelievable run that they gave the fans. By now, they expanded the Arena Condor to over 20,000 capacity, and they were filling it regular. And there were nights in the Arena Condor under the floodlights that these fans just never thought they could have possibly had just a few years before, taking on these mighty teams from all across the continent. And it became really addictive to the club, to the players, to the fans. When they went out narrowly that first season in the quarterfinal to River Plate, they just wanted more the next season. And by then, you know, the story was gaining attention and they signed a new calibre of player in Kleber Santana, a player who played for Atletico Madrid for a number of seasons, played in the Champions League, scored goals in the Champions League as a central dominating sort of midfielder, scored goals against Real Madrid and Barcelona. And that became like a flagship, then a statement, you know, we are here, we're Chapecoense and we're here to stay. And so when they went into that 2016 Copa Sudamericana campaign, by that point, they knew they were good enough to stay in Serie A. They were comfortably mid-table, and it was the Copa Sudamericana became their sole focus and what the club became in existence for and became known for, these unbelievable continental nights where they would go into every single one as the underdog and turn over some mighty team, and especially the Brazilian public and the Brazilian media got behind them, because so often these were Argentinian teams that they were beating, you know, and this story were just snowballing until they found themselves in, after an unbelievably dramatic semi-final, that found themselves qualified for the final.
It's, I mean, you know, the story, you know, the story is incredible, and it's clearly a, you know, a detailed story, but also a story that's incredibly rapid as well, that rapid rise. And, you know, I guess, Gary, listening to, you know, listening to Stephen there, it's, you can't, if you're a fan of football or you love football, no matter who you support, you know, and your team is Chelsea and Steve's team is Liverpool, but there's always that other team. And, you know, and Steve mentioned that, you know, he started supporting Flamengo when he once he'd sort of got a hold of Brazilian football and the love for Brazilian football. But then your eye does, or your heart probably, tends to then wander looking for the stories, the romance of the game. And this side, you know, is one of those great examples of a side that, that unifies football fans. You know, we've mentioned before, you know, only a couple of nights ago about the tribalistic nature of football, but yet there are still sides that that transcend that through their story or through the rise or through sort of, you know, against the odds. And, you know, going up, leading up to this point, you know, fans of football just kind of fell in love with this side.
Well, you know, you have to say it would be difficult not to, you know, and for anybody listening to Stephen relating the story, you know, of this, this meteoric rise with genuine players. And I think I'm right, and Stephen, you can correct me, Chapecó is quite a small place, isn't it? And it's, when I'm reading stories about the games, it always seems to be raining all the time as well. Yeah, so it just added a little bit of lustre. I mean, this isn't a Rio de Janeiro team. It's not a big city team. And it's just... It's you just use the word romance to about this. It's almost it's a story that you cannot. If you're a football fan, you cannot fall in love with this story. And you know, as I said, I just said, if anybody, your listeners, thinking, you know, Stephen's overegged the story, no, he ain't. All he's saying is true. And you know, when you read the book, you know, and When I read it, because I didn't know much about Chapecó as a team. I knew about the plane crash, and then you hear a little bit more about it, what, where they were going, such like, and about the same. But I knew very little about the club itself. And when you start to read, you know, this is extraordinary story, ridiculously romantic story. So, you know, it's a bit of, you know, not a Roy of the Rovers, because there's 11 Roy of the Rovers. In fact, there's the guys in the background as well. It's a tremendous story, and you know, as you say, you know, no matter who you support, if you're a football fan, you can't help but fall in love with the story.
I mean, coming to you, Steve, it's, you know, is, I'm not saying this is why we love football. You know, there's a whole host of reasons of why we love football, but I suppose, you know, you can't lay this at the feet just of football, but I suppose you can, you know, sport in general, but sport is something that offers this potential to come from nothing and almost achieve greatness. And I know greatness is quite a grandiose term, and it's, but it does, it, you know, allows people or a collective to literally come from nothing and achieve something beyond people's wildest dreams. And I guess that's part of the reason why people love the game.
Yeah, it's that sense of hope. And, you know, with football, the sky's the limit. Doesn't matter what football club you are, you know, there's all manner of rags to riches and back again stories, all, you know, scattered all over football, all over the world. And I think it is. It's that sense of hope that it gives you. You know, Stephen said before about, you know, the disparity in the haves and have-nots in Rio and, you know, when he was there and all of that, and it's a well-known facet of life in Brazil, is the distance between the rich and the poor. Yet here is a sport that transcends that, and you know, the people who love it, whether that's just kicking a ball around or, you know, supporting the team they love, it brings such happiness and such joy. Yet in the depths of despair, you know, it can leave you feeling, you know, like the end of the world. And as exaggerated as a phrase as that is, given the circumstances of how this story pans out, that's pretty much how it feels. You know, people's teams are their lives. You know, they thrive on it. You know, it's the main topic of conversation. They might go to a job that they don't like the following morning, but then there's people there that they will talk football about, and it becomes a bearable existence. So it's massively, massively important to people. And yes, it is that hope of attaining something that you've not attained before. I've mentioned before how I, you know, and it's that the levels of football as well, and how a high can be just as high at a lower level than it can be at a higher level. I mentioned before about how I used to live in a little village called Burscoe, on the far out reaches of the Merseyside boundary, and how they, as a, I think they were a third tier non-league side, won the FA Trophy. And it was an incredible thing. And, you know, the scenes in the village were akin to watching Liverpool win the Champions League. It's that sense of joy and reaching out for this, you know, tangible yet often unattainable goal. And it is, it sweeps you away, and it's all of life's troubles can disappear by the fact that your football team is doing well. And, you know, this is what, you know, any club does for you. But when it's a club that isn't used to that kind of success, and then it comes, and it is like it's the fairy tale. It's winning the lottery. It's the magic spell. It's suddenly it's there, and people who don't support that football club get swept on it as well, and they truly will them on. And that's not to say that, you know, people are against the big team that's there in their way. It's not that. It's just that here's this chance for this club and this incredible story to pan out. And it's all based in hopes and dreams. And sometimes those hopes and dreams come true. And this is what it was for Chapecoense. You know, they were on the brink of the greatest dream, and it was shattered.
It's a great point now, because, you know, Stephen, I'm going to hand straight over to you with essentially, you know, on the eve of this final, you know, what comes next?
Well, so we're coming towards the end of that Serie A campaign as well, at the end of the 2016 season. They'd comfortably stayed up, sort of mid-table now. They're a fixture in the Serie A, and they'd become usually popular in the nation, as we've discussed, and they were once again playing Palmeiras. Palmeiras had recovered from the disappointing relegation that they'd suffered a few years earlier, as we've discussed, and they were actually, in that game, Chapecoense versus Palmeiras, at Palmeiras in Sao Paulo, they only needed a draw, the Palmeiras, to win the division, to win the title. They achieved that draw against Chapecoense. Now, because they were playing in Sao Paulo and then flying directly to Medellin for the first leg of the Copa Sudamericana final, they had come up with this route. You know, they would fly from Chapeco to Sao Paulo, stay overnight after the game in Sao Paulo. The airline that they'd hired for their longer Copa Sudamericana trips, they'd been on one of them trips before in a previous leg, they'd had a fledgling airline called Lamia. Now, Lamia, as a startup company, was specialising in corporate flights, particularly trying to seduce football teams on these kind of expeditions. They'd had a lot of big South American clubs flying with them already, international teams, including Argentina. You know, Lionel Messi had been on this plane. But they were cutting corners, and how much Chapecoense or any other football organisation knew about that, we're quite certain that they didn't know anything about it. But one thing that Chapecoense didn't know is that Lamia didn't have the authority to fly within Brazil, daft as that sounds. So what they'd done before was get commercial flights. They were used to getting commercial flights. That's what they did internally within Brazil. It's what they did for the shorter continental trips. So what they agreed to do was get a short commercial flight to meet the Lamia airline outside of Brazil, to in a country where they did have jurisdiction to fly. So after the game against Palmeiras, they stayed overnight in Sao Paulo, got a commercial flight from Sao Paulo to Santa Cruz in Bolivia. Now, the distance from Santa Cruz to Medellin is 1.6 thousand kilometers. The distance that a airplane, the type that Lamia were operating, could travel was 1.6 thousand kilometers. When they asked to do this journey direct, again, this has nothing to do with a football club at all. They're not in charge of this. They're not responsible for this. This is the airline's responsibility. When they asked to do this with the airline coordinators, the air traffic controllers, they got rejected. They told they needed to have a fuel stop. And they scheduled them a fuel stop at Cabija, which was sort of a third of the way, which would have been fine. Small, tiny airport. For various reasons, the flight is delayed. They get to Santa Cruz successfully on the commercial flight from Sao Paulo, no problems. But for various reasons, they are delayed. The Lamia flight is delayed. They were on strict timescales. Again, they didn't translate this to the football club. They were on strict timescales as to when they had to get to this small airport by, because it was not a 24-hour airport, it shuts. They didn't get there in time. They knew when they set off they weren't going to get there in time. The pilot, who it transpired was also one of the co-owners of Lamia, a small fledgling company. The pilots are the owners. Conflict of interest there right away. This pilot, capable of making life-changing, life-costing decisions, was directly associated with how much money this company was going to make from various decisions. And so when they knew they couldn't make it to the original scheduled airport, he was tempted to fly direct, knowing that they would be pretty much on fumes by the time they got there. His co-pilot urged him to go to a different airport, a bigger airport, one that would be open, but that would open up all kinds of wranglings in terms of, why have you decided to do this almost emergency refuel? What were you thinking? So the main pilot and co-owner decided not to do that. He was tempted. Transcribed the discussions that were caught on that were recorded off the black box in the book. He was very tempted. He was torn between his heart and his head as to what were the right thing to do. He decided to go for it. Now, these sliding doors moments, all the way through the book, there's these sliding doors moments, be it on the football pitch, be it on that aeroplane. You know, every single time Chapecoense just scraped through a league stage, or just avoided relegation, or just qualified for the next round of the Copa Sudamericana, all you can think is, I kind of wish they hadn't. Because we all know how this story ends. And these were the sliding doors moments that were going on in that cockpit, whilst all the players, the staff, the management were so excited to be getting to their destination. It were the biggest adventure of their life. And in the cockpit, there was turmoil. That turmoil turned to peril when a flight had also recorded that they needed to do an emergency landing for a fuel issue. It turned out that they just had a faulty fuel gauge, but they had a very sensible pilot who was taking no chances and decided that he needed to do an emergency landing. Unfortunately, his emergency landing was at the airport of Medellin, where the Lamia flight needed to land. They were told, the Lamia flight, because they hadn't declared an emergency, were told to hold in an holding pattern and perform a circular motion while they waited for clearance to land, while this flight that had declared a fuel emergency was given priority. They wasted their last bit of fuel doing this holding pattern before he finally said to the air traffic controllers, "Now I need to land, I'm now declaring an emergency." They give him clearance to land. Unfortunately, they ran out of fuel by the time he'd finished his emergency announcement. All the engines shut off, all the lights went off, and they started plummeting towards the earth 9 miles away from the runway. and crashed into the mountains of Cerro Gordo.
When you hear people, you know, hear people talk about it, we kind of know the story, or you think you know the story, sorry. And, you know, obviously we, you know, we've read the book, guys, and we sort of knew what was coming. But, you know, Gary, it's, you know, we've written books, but we've not written about tragedy. And I think I still can't get my head around the sort of, and this sounds quite trite, and I don't mean for it to, based on what's happened and what this is all about, but Stephen undertaking the sort of task of writing this story and about, you know, something I mentioned at the beginning, and writing about this event and this tragedy, and certainly listening to him speak there, it just kind of brings home how difficult it is to convey a story like this in a sensitive yet informative and succinct way.
Yeah. We write stories about football games being lost and called it tragedy. Yeah, it's just no comparison. And I've never written anything that's sort of included a genuine tragedy of this magnitude. And I wouldn't know how to do it. But Stephen's book does this with a wonderful empathy. It's very easy sort of make it sound dramatic. And obviously it is dramatic, tragic, but there's it doesn't lose the human empathy, the human story. And I just want sort of example. Stephen mentioned the guy earlier, Danilo, the goalkeeper, and you know I recently got sort of quite attached. And this is what Stephen did really well in the book. You become attached to the characters. And you know there's going to be a plane crash. You know that overwhelmingly that many of them are going to die. But you also know there's going to be some survivors. And I was just hoping that this goalkeeper was going to be one of the survivors. Now, I'm not going to say whether he was or not. People have to read the book to find out. But, you know, it's a skill. It's a skill. And it's having that sort of that fine touch, that light understanding, the empathy to tell a story like that. With the right amount of pathos, and Stephen does this really, really well. And it's an emotional story. The whole book is an emotional story, but you talk about ramping it up to the 2nth degree when you sort of, you know, you hear about this and the sheer terror of the moment when the lights go off and the plane starts plummeting to Earth. I mean, you know, it's everybody's nightmare in an aeroplane, I suppose, but you know, this was something that these guys, you know, experienced, lived and died by.
Yeah, I mean, like we say, Steve, you know, it's an incredible, the whole thing is an incredible story, like I said at the beginning. It's almost a podcast that's probably got even more levels than, you know, than just the two. You know, it's the tragedy, it's the hope, it's the rise of a football team, it's how you write a book about such a subject, and, you know, and how you write it in a sensitive way. And I suppose, Steve, like Gary's just said there, it's, you know, sort of undertaking, you know, we'll ask Stephen this about this in a sec, but certainly from my perspective, I'm not sure I would be comfortable in my own ability to, well, I know I wouldn't, there's no point in even saying it, I know I wouldn't, in being able to write this story. And like Gary said, you know, to create that attachment, how, because, you know, you know what it's like, Steve. You know, you've written books, and the books live with you while you're writing them. You live the story that you're writing about. It's the first thing you think of when you wake up. It's the last thing when you go to bed. But when it's this sort of a story, you know, it must just be there all the time, day in, day out, leading up to this event.
Oh, it's a massive responsibility, you know, to carry. You know, you're carrying a weight of a description there. To be able to tell this story and to do, you know, the those who died justice with it as well, and you know the skill behind that is immense. I can't imagine doing that. I'd have to summon up some kind of, you know, hidden skills if they're there to be able to do that. But Stephen does this beautifully. You know, it's that sense of humanity, and we've spoken many times over these podcasts of books that touch, you know, human nature. You know, they go beyond being a football book, and and this more than any of them probably ticks that box. And it's the, when we spoke of hope earlier on, it's also that hopelessness with this. And this is a very unique book in that it manages to do that, you know, about the hope of a team that has risen unexpectedly from absolutely nowhere to be able to reach this pinnacle, yet the hopelessness of a situation that was eminently avoidable. And it's such a joy and a sadness combined, you know, that the story and the characters and the club and the location, the town, and it's, for me, it's just an amazing book and an amazingly delivered book that Stephen's put across. It's a beautiful thing.
It is, and I suppose, you know, a question that I've been sort of wanting to ask you for a while, Stephen, and I guess, you know, we're at the point now where it's sort of appropriate to ask it, but did you feel a weight of responsibility writing the book, you know, and did it sit with you through the duration, or was it something that you thought, okay, it is a responsibility, I'm going to undertake it, and then sort of move on, or is it just something that hung with you until it was finished?
It was something that escalated whilst I was doing the writing and the research. I always knew that there were going to be hard things to read about, hard things to write about. I wasn't quite ready for how difficult some of them got. I remember one time, one afternoon, I discovered a YouTube video and I was sobbing into my iPad because obviously I knew about the fate of this young man, a 20-year-old had just discovered that his young wife was pregnant, and his friends of Chapecoense, his teammates at Chapecoense had thrown him one of these, you know, well, with the help of his wife, they'd created a little ruse of how to tell him while they were in an hotel away from home. They give him a little gift, pretending it was from a female admirer, and, you know, it's loyalty to his wife meant that he shunned them, he turned them away. I'm not taking that. They convinced him that that would be rude. You must at least open the card. When he opens the card, and this is all caught on the video, the expression on his face changes, tears start to go down his face, and what you realise is that it was a card from his wife telling him that he was about to become a dad, and in the little bag there's a pair of tiny shoes. That was me done for the day. Yeah, there were things like that that were, even though I did feel that weight, that I knew I had to tell these people's story really, really well. I didn't want to leave anybody out. Every single person that was on that plane gets a mention. Every single body that died is who the book is dedicated to right at the start. That includes the pilot. The pilot made some horrendous mistakes, but in part of my investigation, I did sort of find that he could have been under some severe external pressure to make them mistakes, to make them decisions. So, you know, in Chapecoense ever since, I have a round of applause at every home match on the 71st minute. That's the number of people that died, 71. So they don't choose to leave him out either. That's the humanity of the Brazilian people. And yeah, I'd do a sort of an obituary chapter towards the end where I just make sure that everybody gets, I tell everybody's background story, how they came to be where they were, because I just think everybody that died that day, the playing staff and the Chapecoense staff really do all, every one of them deserve to have their story told within this story. Because they're all part of it. Like I said earlier, the sliding doors moments, it's not just about the players that unfortunately died. It's about the players that survived and what they had to live with after that, and not even just the players, but staff members. Some extraordinary stories as we're discussing these sliding doors moments of how some individuals ended up not being on that flight. How do they live with that, you know? And so I did discuss some of that in the book as well. One story, actually, if you'll indulge me, that I've sort of discovered since. While I was writing the book, the manager at the time, Son, travelled everywhere with the team. And because he travelled everywhere internally within Brazil, he only ever needed his ID. He didn't need his passport to get on the flight. So because they were going to Palmeiras first, to São Paulo first, to play against Palmeiras, he sort of packed his bag as normal. He didn't take his passport. What that meant was that he was going to miss out on the flight. He realised that morning in the hotel at São Paulo that he didn't have his passport and he couldn't travel to Medellín. Now, he was about to miss one of the greatest achievements of his father's career, one of the greatest achievements in Chapecoense's history. It was heartbroken. It was actually at the airport that he realised and had to turn back and get a flight back to Chapeco. When I told my friend in Brazil, Sergio, that I'd discovered this little anecdote and this sliding doors moment of how this young lad survived not being on the plane, Sergio said to me, well, that's wrong. You don't need, you know, because of the way South America works, he didn't need his passport to get to Medellin. He would have only needed his ID. He wouldn't have needed anything different than the flight that he'd got on from Chapeco to Sao Paulo. I don't understand what this story means, he questioned it. At which point I thought, well, I'm sorry, Sergio, but this is what my researchers told me. I like the anecdote. It gives a human element. It's another one of these sliding doors moments. I really was transfixed with these moments of, I think in the aviation industry, they call it the Swiss cheese effect, where you've got slices of cheese, each one of them's got an hole in it. And if you get enough slices together with the holes in the right place, you might just get an hole all the way through. And that's what happened with this flight. But that leaves a lot of cheese still intact, you know, and these stories of individuals who managed to survive what should have been their death were a way of bringing some light onto it, you know. So I didn't think much else of it, but I'd actually tried contacting this the manager's son in the meantime, and he months and months and months later got back to me and told me the story. Sorry, he told Sergio the story, and Sergio relayed it to me. What had happened was Sergio was right. Sergio was right all along. He could have gone on that flight with his ID only. He just didn't know that at the time. Not only that, he'd shared a room with his father, the manager. His father didn't know that he could travel to Medellin with just his ID. He thought he needed his passport. They were discussing this in frustration in the lift in the hotel going down and in the lobby and to the airport where they were going to drop his dad off to get the flight to Medellin, and he was going to go and get the flight to Chapeco. They were discussing it with other players in the car. They were discussing it at the airport in front of other people. Not one of them people seemingly knew or decided to tell him, or for whatever reason, they were preoccupied with other things, they didn't hear. Not one of all them dozens of people said, oh no, you can go, it's fine. That is just amazing to me. I don't actually convey that in the book. In the book, I just tell the short story of the fact that he forgot his passport. But yeah, there's a lot of stories like that that go both ways. People that ended up being on the flight tragically, and people that didn't make it onto the flight and survived it. And as you've said, I did want to, Gary, as you just said, sensitive as it is, and I'm very conscious of that, I did kind of want to leave the reader guessing exactly who died and who survived. And that becomes because a few of the players who I've sort of emboldened as big characters in it, a couple of them don't make it into the squad for different reasons, injuries and things like that, you know, and again, they would have died. And some of the main characters, of course, do make it onto the flight and never came home.
I guess, Gary, this is why this is such a great book, isn't it? You know, you sort of listen to Stephen there and, you know, the stories that he's told there, and, you know, and that's something that he's learned afterwards. But this is why the book is so good, because it's so skillfully told, delicately told, but yet brutally told. I don't know if that makes sense, but I know what I mean. So you kind of just have to understand me if you can.
It made total sense to me, Stu. It made total sense to me. Yeah, it is. It's the what's the phrase that people use for something delicately told, but with a streak of iron? It's the velvet glove and the it's the iron fist and the velvet glove, isn't it? But within that, you know, it is. It's a beautifully told story, but there is that brutality, you know, that is inescapable. I think that's the word. You know, everything feels so inescapable, and it's to have such great joy as part of the story, yet this, you know, the indelible sense of foreboding. You know, because you know the end, and in a way, you're going through, you know, some great parts of the story, and you part of you wishing it wasn't so great for them. You know, because of the outcome that is still to come.
I mean, obviously, you know, we're already sort of well over the hour, but it, you know, for you, Stephen, you know, that obviously there's the aftermath. Obviously, there's, you know, there's the tragedy that happens, but as seems to run through this story is this sort of thread of hope, and that starts a way back. You know, sort of in the formation of the club and the rise of the club, and then the, like you say, the near demise of the club, but then it comes back again, you know, and then you have this, you know, the ultimate tragedy and the terminal loss of playing staff and backroom staff, and, you know, it's almost a decimation that just looks like, you know, this is just, it's just one incident, just too many for this club, but yet, you know, as has run through the story, actually, you know, the present and the future actually is sort of burns a little bit brighter.
It does. The story made such an impact, particularly in Brazil. As we said earlier, there's a phrase been long said that when Brazil lose a football match, the country cries. Well, in this case, the world wept. And there was a rallying cry around Chapecoense after this, obviously, as you'd expect. They'd made such solid relationships with other teams in Serie A through the work ethic and the story that they were telling, that teams and players couldn't wait to help them in terms of the recovery. They kept their base from what they'd had before. The players that survived carried on. The management structure was rebuilt from previous staff. And they really kept that, but they just added players. But ironically, the players that they were getting loaned for free from the other teams within the Brasileiro, the bigger teams within the Brasileiro, the more wealthy teams, were technically better players. And they went on to finish the following season in the highest position of the lot. But you can only imagine that every match was tainted in a way. You were playing against Chapecoense. It was more than just a football match. Like say, you had this big round of applause at the 71st minute every time. There were ceremonies. There was a heartfelt passion for the club. You can almost imagine that other teams didn't quite go into it with the same killer instinct that they might have had against other teams. So maybe that was a bit of a false dawn. The following season, they stayed up by the skin of the teeth. in a real fighting way, in a typical Chapecoense way. That is as far as that is where I end the book, actually, with that dramatic survival once again, which is done in that manner that Chapecoense always did it before the crash. Really going back to that original style of play, that grittiness. What's happened since? They got relegated the following season. They actually got relegated on the third anniversary of the tragedy. But they are currently sitting pretty in Serie B, 8 points clear at the top of the league, and 13 points clear of fifth place. So virtually guaranteed to be back in Serie A next season, which is great. Even better news recently from the humanitarian side of what we're discussing. The court proceedings that have happened over the last 4 years have just been horrendous. It turned out that Lamia weren't even insured. They didn't have the right insurance to be travelling, to be flying in Colombia. They were just over the Colombian border when the crash happened. They'd allowed their insurance to expire anyway because there was wranglings over the level of cover that they needed, and they had not paid the extra. It was a real mess. Underwriter after underwriter after underwriter, court case after court case, criminal court cases, civil court cases. Nobody taking responsibility, nobody of almost alive to take responsibility. There were arrests, there were huge civil lawsuits, there was appeals, counter-appeals, and this has gone on for years and years and years. It's still going on now. It's got up to such a high level where they've had to take it to America. And in a recent court case in Florida, they actually awarded in damages over $800 million to be split out equally between the families, which some simple math tell you that's over $100 million per tragic family. Now, it's one of them cases where there's no amount of money that can ever bring back their loved ones. But after all these years and the disparity, as we discussed earlier, of poverty in Brazil and these young families, these footballers were providing a wage, a standard of living that they never thought they'd have, and that got robbed from these families. So, you know, as painful as it feels to discuss money after a tragedy like that, at some point you have to, because these families need to live. And it's awful that so many people in suits wanted to stop them living the lives, stop them from being out of that poverty cycle that they'd managed to drag themselves out of, because nobody wanted to pay them any money. And it's difficult to know who should have paid that money. But as things stand now, touch wood, it looks like they are going to get what they deserve. Just going back to the something I should have mentioned earlier of how much it actually touched me, the humanitarian side of it, we'll not discuss them. The star striker, Bruno Rangel, who got plucked from poverty, well, I've currently got upstairs asleep in his bed a one-year-old baby called Bruno. So I think that just tells you how much the story and the humanitarian side meant to me.
It's great. And I mean, I think, you know, like I say, the book is wonderful. The story is almost the stuff of movies and films and Hollywood, but it's not. You know, it's a very, very real story. You know, and I guess, Gary, to sort of, you know, to sum up, it is a book that, you know, you might think you know the story. I thought I knew the story, or certainly all that I kind of needed to know, or, you know, I knew enough to be able to pass comment on it, but actually I knew nothing about it. And you know, Gary, this book really does tell the story, or, you know, it ultimately tells the story for anybody who's interested in this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you said there is probably the same experience that most football fans in the UK would sort of concur with. You know, they saw the story. All right, that's a team that sort of came from nowhere, and, you know, they're underdogs and they did well. It's a terrible tragedy, a plane crash. But yeah, you know, that's hardly the story. But anybody who wants to know the true story, the real story, the full story, the human story, should read Stephen's book, because so to use that old hackneyed phrase, all human life is there. There's the joy, there's the tragedy, and there's everything in between. And it's one of those books. You mentioned this earlier, Stu. You know, that's it's almost not about football. It is about football, but it's about people as well. And it's the joy is for the people, the tragedy is for the people. And you know, football keeps going. And Atletico Mineiro, who they were going to play, agreed to concede the trophy to Chapecoense, which is a wonderful gesture. And so they've got that sort of, in the Hall of Fame of, the club as well. But it almost makes no difference. It's a bit of silverware, but it doesn't compare to the people who've lost their lives, the families who have been torn asunder by the tragedy. And it's one of those terrible things where they were offered a glimpse of a ridiculous amount of glory, and just to have it snatched away and plunged headlong into terrible tragedy.
I mean, Steve, it's, sort of, I guess, last comment from you, but like I say, I think, sport, tragedy is such an overused word in sport, and I think yourself that sort of mentioned it earlier. It's, we write about, if a team have lost, it's a tragedy, or if they missed a scoring opportunity, it's a tragedy. But what Stephen has written about is the ultimate tragedy, never mind a footballing tragedy. Like we said at the beginning, it's just, football that it has as a backdrop. I think it's a brave thing to do, to write this book. And it's something we've talked about before with regards to the history of the game and keeping the history alive and, making sure the story's there to tell. I also think that these stories are also important because it takes a brave person to write them, but they still have to be written and people shouldn't shy away from them. And I feel guilty for that because I know I couldn't and I wouldn't. I suppose it's like somebody deciding to write about Hillsborough, or it's somebody deciding to write about the Bradford Fire, or, I suppose what I'm saying is I'm really pleased that someone does do it. I just know it won't be me, and I feel like I need to apologise for that. I don't know how you feel about it, Steve.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I think what Stephen's done here is he's taken the beauty of the people that are a part of a tragic event. And within that allows Stephen's passion to shine through, because we've spoken about it on previous podcasts about how it's the passion of the topic, the passion of the subject matter. And that applies with this as much as any other book. And that, in a way, sounds wrong, but it's not wrong, because it's the passion of the people and where that team came from, and the people who generated that team and made them get to where they were, and what they were on the brink of playing in when disaster struck. And that's a certain type of art, to be able to remove the disaster, to remove the tragedy, or move it to the side. So it's always visible, it's always there, but it's moved to the side in a way where it shares the stage with the victims, and it's celebrating the victims of such tragedy. And it's an amazing piece of work to be able to do that. I doubt I could do that myself as much as you, Stu. But yes, this is what Stephen ultimately delivers. And it's a fantastic book, that his passion for the team and the players behind it and the staff behind it and, the people is a testament to Stephen and the topic. It's a brilliant thing.
Like I say, it is incredible. Stephen, thank you. Well, one, thank you for writing it on behalf of anybody like myself who's just not brave enough to write these sort of things. But also, thank you for coming on. And like I say, I suppose it's, this is clearly now a story that that you're going to be tied to for the rest of your life. And I guess there's, you know, there's no getting away from that. You're so embedded and ingrained in the story, it's just going to sit with you, you know, for the rest of your life. But it's great to have you on here to sort of, certainly to educate myself. You know, obviously I can't speak for Gary and Steve and, you know, what they already knew, but hopefully the people who've listened to this as well have an even deeper understanding of what is, you know, it's an important story, but it's a story. It's one of those stories where the facts do need to be known. You know, people need to understand the full story and not just make assumptions, I suppose, like I did, of what you think you know, what you think is true. It's important that the whole story is told. And like I say, I'm really grateful for you coming on here and sharing it with us.
Look, thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Gary, and thank you, Stephen, for your kind words. It was a roller coaster ride researching and writing it. Very, very rewarding. And as you said, Stuart, it is something that I feel associated with now. And it's sort of on my list of future things to do that I'll attend a game at the Arena Condor and write another book about everything that's happened since and the court cases and whatever ends up happening with all that, and sort of a diary account of how I finally end up at the Arena Condor. So yeah, it's not something that I just dropped the moment that I put the pen down. It's it does mean something to me. It really does.
It's, I mean, like I said, the book is, you know, From Triumph to Tragedy, the Chapecoense story. And it's, like I say, it's a must read for, you know, football fans. It's, you know, it's a must read for people who love stories. And it is a story, you know, it ultimately it is the story. It's a tragic story, but it's a story that is real life. It's a story that has hope. It's, you know, it's all of those things. Gary, quite a, I suppose, similar to the story, I guess. It's been a roller coaster podcast, this one.
It has, yeah. I mean, as you say, I'd recommend anybody to read Stephen's book. If you're interested in football, it's a great read. If you're not interested in football, it's still a great read. Because it's football's a backcloth. It's a human story as well. And it's a story told immaculately well by Stephen.
For you, Steve, you know, last word. Like we said, it's important, isn't it, that these stories are told?
Oh, it's massively important. You know, we've said before about it's that sense of legacy, and to be able to shine a light on people and to be able to tell the story of people who can no longer do it. And Stephen's, you know, an absolute genius at it. You know, and there's another book that he's just written as well, which follows the similar theme, you know, of being able to tell a story of an individual who can no longer tell that story.
It's, I mean, I suppose last question then, Steve, you know, with regards to, you know, books, you know, is there another one sort of in the pipeline that we can look out for?
Yes, I've just recently published my second book. It's called The Man of All Talents, The Extraordinary Life of Douglas Clark. Douglas Clark was a sporting legend and war hero from my hometown of Huddersfield. He pioneered was one of many pioneers for the sport of rugby league, was one of the best players of his generation. In the early 1900s, a member of the Great Britain team that went over to Australia in the infamous Rorke's Drift Test match, did a clean sweep of trophies with Huddersfield, or Fartown as though known then, in the following season before World War One, stopped them in the tracks. And he was discharged from the army with a military medal for bravery after saving countless lives, which is all accounted for in his war diaries, which I transcribe in the book. It's truly harrowing read. And then he went on to, despite being told never to take part in professional sport again or any form of physical activity, he went on to go back into rugby, have a second Hall of Fame career with Huddersfield and Great Britain. And then when he hung his rugby boots up, he decided to take up wrestling and became a British and world heavyweight champion at that as well. He was quite the man. And yeah, I've decided to tell that story. And yeah, that's I'm very pleased with how that's come out.
I think, like I say, I mean, you know, all that's left for me to sort of say, you know, is to thank you for coming on. But I think ultimately your career lies as a great teller of stories. I think Stephen, you know, you tell the story so well, and it's not meant in a patronizing way. You know, it is a true compliment. It's not easy to tell stories that engage and get it right, but you are a really, really good storyteller.
Thank you. It means a lot, Stuart. It really does.
And if there's, like I say, if you've got more stories, if you find more stories to tell, you know, please come back on and share them with us, if you don't mind.
Anytime. Thank you.
Obviously, you know, it's been a great episode. The book's great. You know, Stephen was a great, great guest to have. And it was great to get a perspective of the book from the, you know, from the author's perspective, because that's where you get a real feel for the book, but also a real feel for this story. Obviously, please thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.